That. So the talk is about work done in collaboration with Boris Altshuler, Volodya Kravtsov, and Igor Alenier. It was published a couple of weeks ago, together with experimental paper by Danish Shahar Group, Ovadia, Sasepa, and Shahar. But I will be talking not only about experiments, the last experiment published here, which is to a considerable extent was induced by our ideas, but about some older experiments where a term superinsulator has been introduced. I will not be talking much about superinsulator though, but I will just explain what was seen, what are these giant current jumps in current voltage characteristics in some thin films in materials which actually undergo a superconductor insulating transition. So let me start just from this. So this is something which many of you have heard. And this transition is going in many materials. So idea is that you take typically some semiconductor film and change disorder in this film. A most easy way to change disorder is just to change film thickness. And then as a function of thickness, when you lower temperature, more clean samples, which are normally thicker, eventually see that resistance dramatically drops and goes practically to zero, or at least to experimental zero, so it's a good superconductor. But for thinner, more disordered films, resistance goes up. And this picture implies the existence of some quantum phase transition at zero temperature between a superconductor and insulator as a function of disorder. So this is, by the way, taken from a relatively recent review by Goldman and Markovich, I think. And this is a picture which is already well known for about 20 years. And picture is well established. There is there are different theoretical approaches to this. I don't think that any theory describes all details of experiment, but there is sort of an overwhelming agreement that the reason for this transition is that in a material which is intrinsically superconducting, some granularity occurs. Either material was granular from the very beginning, or in a warm amorphous material, it's a self-induced granularity. And then, although local parameter or the parameter in each grain is still there, there is modulus of delta, phase coherence between different grains or different parts of this sample is lost, and therefore superconductivity is lost. But it's still got a gap in energy spectrum, therefore superconductor becomes an insulator. In the very beginning, it seemed that the point in resistance where transition occurs is more or less universal, that resistance there, or sheet resistance is a order of 2H over E squared. I think that now there are many more results which show that it's not the case, but anyway, the picture is like that. And this transition also can be checked by changing magnetic field. You can destroy a superconductor by applying a big enough field, but then system goes not to the metal, but to an insulator. So this is all well known, and I will not be talking about this anymore. And subject of the talk, actually, is highly unusual nonlinear electronic transport on the insulating side of this superconductor insulating transition. In some disordered films, mostly by indium oxide and titanium nitride, but also some other. So we are talking about insulating side of superconducting insulator transition. So of course, idea is that something which is going on there is very much due to some correlation effect of superconducting type. However, these systems have been investigated for quite a while, and even in linear regime on the sort of metal or insulating part without superconductivity, behavior is very unusual. Behavior of resistance is very unusual. Namely, behavior of resistance shows very good Arrhenius law at low temperatures. And Arrhenius law, of course, is something which that's the only thing you could expect for band insulator. But this stuff is not a band insulator. And Arrhenius delta is very small. It's of order of Kelvin, could be a few Kelvin, whatever. And at this materials, which are actually Anderson insulators, or widely believed to be Anderson insulators, people expect to see variable range coping. So here, gamma should be not of order one in this dependence, but it should be sort of mods variable range coping, one-fourth in three-dimensional materials, or probably at lower temperature, Efrosh-Klofsky, due to the appearance of the Coulomb gap in density of states with gamma equal one half, but it's not like that. Experiments in this particular type of materials show the Arrhenius behavior. And this is, again, known for already probably about 15 years or more, and to the best of my knowledge, is not yet explained. There are some ideas why Arrhenius type of behavior is there, but no overall picture is ready. Let's say that we assume that we are dealing with materials where this unusual behavior with gamma of order one is being observed. So these materials are already, of course, becomes sort of insulating when temperature goes below this delta, below, say, 1 Kelvin or whatever is the ratio. But this, of course, from this you would only expect some sort of smooth transition from a bad metal to some usual insulator. But that was not what observed at finite voltage. The giant jumps in IV characteristics have been observed on indium oxides by Shahar group about 4 years ago, and then in a set of experiments by Baturina and co-authors with theoretical support by Vinokur and company. And in all these type of experiments, jumps between low resistive and high resistive states are really quite dramatic. They could be 4, 5, or 6 order in magnitude. Jump like here, okay, it's taken from Baturina's work. It's practically vertical, so that there are no data points between last here and first there. Actually, in her experiments, there are no data points down here at all, but in more detailed experiments, you see that you can actually reach the level of resistance, which is so high that it's no longer measurable. There is huge noise here, and this noise is just due to the fact that the resistance of your voltmeter becomes smaller than the resistance of this sample. So all you know that the resistance is very, very high. Still, of course, not nearly as high as the resistance of China cup if you put it down 1 Kelvin. Because there you've got a real sort of gap, real band gap, and then the resistance would be measured in, not in astronomical, but in astrophysical numbers. But still, it's quite a high resistance, and of course, what is most important is this abrupt jump. And this jumps from kilo-ohm to giga-ohm regime happened in systems which are tantalizingly close to superconductors. So what these samples are precisely the same samples in which typically this superconducting insulator transition occurs. And they are driven to insulating part, either by inducing by magnetic field, so that there were samples which were superconducting, or by increasing disorder in typically superconducting samples. So, of course, when it's so close to superconductor, some collective effects are somehow in the air. And if you look at the titles of a good amount of experimental papers, they all imply non-trivial collective insulating state in these materials close to superconductor. This was stated by Shahar group, as well by the group of Baturin and Vinokur, who introduced also a term superinsulator. Superinsulator, probably not because the resistance is so dramatically high. You can get gigohms in many ways, but because of this very, very dramatic jump. But of course, superinsulator had also a different connotation. It's by analogy with a superconductor. You still got some collective effects, probably pair creations, and then transport of their pairs was allegedly rather unusual and led to this sort of transition. I will not be commenting on theory of superinsulator, which has been developed by this group, because I want to attract your attention to somewhat different stuff. Actually, this behavior had been observed 10 years before that in these materials. Well, I realize that I forgot why is yttrium or ytterbium. Yeah, high TC people, of course, should know this quite firmly. So again, this is material which experiences 3 to 4 orders, sometimes 5 orders in magnitude jumps, in the very similar IV characteristics, but they're absolutely not in the vicinity of superconducting insulating transition. Therefore, some other explanation, which again I will not be talking about right now, has been sort of offered here, but because it was not in the vicinity of something very interesting, it was not a possibility to claim a new state of matter or something like that. It was sort of modestly published in PISREF, not even PISREF letters, not speaking about nature science, and didn't attract much attention. Another material of this sort actually was published very recently in Nature, or Nature Materials, actually. And this is magnetite, just some sort of oxide of some sort of iron oxide. And jumps, again, are up to 4 or 5 orders in magnitude. A difference is that here, experiments are being done at almost room temperature, okay, nitrogen temperature, sort of 60, 70, 100 Kelvin, but jumps are still many orders of magnitude. Of course, here we don't talk about any sort of superconductivity, but people also talk about some rather non-trivial collective effects, which I will not be, again, analyzing. So the idea is that when you see, oh, absolutely, hysteresis is very characteristic of all this. It's all the other one as well, and I will be talking about this in detail. This is quite important for what we are seeing here. All these IV characteristics are extremely hysteretic. To our taste, is of course not accidental. But the point here is that when you see so similar behavior in so different materials, you might expect that some phenomenological description might serve better, and that's what I will be talking about today. But let's stress what are common features in all this. So all these materials show a rather strong disorder already in a low resistive state. In low resistive state, resistance is of order of quantum resistance. But take it sort of very liberally. There is no universality, whatever resistance could be 10 kilo ohms or could be up to 100. It's just of order of this quantum, not necessarily g equal 1, but definitely not g equal 100, and definitely not g equal 10 to the minus 2. So your dimensional conductance is of order 1, so you are on the edge of what would be sort of normal Anderson transition between metal and insulator. And of course, resistance in high resistive states is orders of magnitude bigger than that. But we already start with a dirty case. Then, Arrhenius law, okay, this, I cannot tell anything about magnetite. To see Arrhenius, you know, they need to have temperatures for that materials which will be of order of 1000 Kelvin. It's not that easy to make these measurements. But in all others, they see something like very steep dependence at temperatures below a certain delta of resistance on temperature, very steep. That's an important point here. And variable range Hopping is not observed anywhere in these materials, either with MOD or with Efrosh-Klofsky exponent. And also voltage threshold at which jumps occur increases with change in delta. Delta could be changed either by disorder or very easily by magnetic field. It's much faster than change of delta itself. Relatively small change of delta could lead to orders of magnitude change in the threshold voltage. So we suggest here a phenomenological explanation of all this. And a main idea is that what is seen in experiments of this sort is just bistability due to overheating. No qualitatively new behavior, no new state of matter, but just overheating is, in our view, the cause of these giant jumps. However, it's not that trivial, because overheating, of course, happens in Hopping materials, but it's not as mundane as in metals. In metals, all experimentalists know that to avoid overheating at low temperatures is their main point. In Hopping materials, Hopping is normally due to electron-phonon interactions. And of course, electrons try phonons many times before making a hop in this situation. And then you expect a full thermalization, or almost full thermalization, of course. In non-equilibrium, there is never exact thermalization, but you would expect something very close to this. Therefore, of course, but this here is. Sure, sure. But no, it's not. It's not perpendicular because I don't make any strong statements about metals. Overheating there, of course, happens all the time just because it's very hard to reach a fridge temperature. That's what you mean. That your entire system is actually warmer than environment, right? Here. Again, because currents, which you expect here, are very slow, very small, relatively. You don't normally expect overheating in respect to the environment temperature in Hopping conductors. And what I told on top of this, you do not expect very much a difference in temperatures between electronic and phonon systems, just because Hopping conductivity is due to probing by electrons of phonon systems. However, you don't expect this very much, but it's known. And it's a set of works by Misha Gershenzon by sort of beginning of 2000, where actually overheating in Hopping regime was investigated, both in both senses, both in the meaning that you may be in a situation where temperature of fridge is not actually achieved by your system. But they also, although not very clearly and not very, now Misha says that it was clear, but to my taste, it was not very clearly stated that electronic temperature could be different from phononic temperature. That's what we impose here. That's our main assumption. Now, let me actually list them. So first, we assume that electron-electron interactions is strong enough, so there is internal thermalization between electrons, and one can talk about electronic temperature. Then, we assume that cooling is mainly due to electron-phonon interaction. What is possible to check that cooling is definitely not due to samples, sorry, not due to leads, because effectively it didn't depend on the sample length. And if it is internal, we assume that this is mainly due to electron-electron interaction. However, this electron-photon interaction is not very efficient, which could lead to Joule overheating. Then we assume that linear resistance has steep Arrhenius-like T-dependence, and this T-dependence remains valid at a finite voltage, but T should be substituted by electronic temperature. This already assumes a non-phonon mechanism for achieving this behavior of this dependence of resistance on temperature. And of course, this electron temperature should be found from the balance of Joule heating supplied to the system and phonon cooling. So in a nutshell, we just have heat balance equation where Joule heating, just V squared over R, is equal to sort of in and out cooling and heating by phonon systems. And this should have a power law dependence. You wouldn't expect anything else. I would show a couple of trivial models in a moment, but that's actually is quite a generic behavior. If this is the case, I can just see how this behavior can be rewritten. I just multiply both sides by resistance. If I took here beta equals 6, this would be this behavior is like that. V here is a constant, and in this blue region, if I draw a straight line, it has three intersections with the red line. So it means that this equation, in a certain region of voltages and temperatures, might have three solutions. One, as usual, is unstable, and two stable solutions will remain. Again, I have written this heat balance equation, and this red line is left-hand side of this equation, dependence on T electron of this product. So you see, I just need to solve this equation numerically. I rewritten this in this way. V here is a constant, so I've got this dependence, and here I've got only one solution. Here I also have only one solution. When I cross this red line by V squared, which is constant. And in this region, I might have three solutions. As simple as that. Of course, unstable solution doesn't count. Again, here I did not write what is on a vertical axis because it's just this equation. Horizontal one is T electron. It's just a function of T electron. And this is a point where T electron equals to T phonon. So it's just all very simple. It's all undergraduate physics. I have written this heat balance, and I see that it might be three solutions. Of course, only two of them are stable. Unstable also can play a certain role. So before going to consequence of this, I just want to tell you very quickly, because microscopics here doesn't matter, but I want to tell you very quickly how can we model this, how can we get this T beta minus T beta. So I think everybody knows that electron photon scattering rate in clean metals is just like that. It's T cube, dimensionalized by Debye temperature, at least when we are in Debye model. Here it's, of course, simply phase volume considerations, so that's very stable. If we are in a semiconductor, then we've got here an additional factor, which may be very small, just because, you know, your electron waves are now very long wave, and of course there is an averaging of polarization due to phonons under lambda, so it gives you this suppression in the case where electron density is low. Strange enough, this is not that much of a textbook fact, but it's straightforward. And then energy relaxation just immediately follows from trivial kinetic equation. I just write energy per volume as density of states times epsilon times Fermi function integrated over energy. I take time derivative of both sides. I substitute F in trivial tau approximation with this tau, and I immediately got this result. Tau squared divided by tau, T squared divided by tau, first taken on electron temperature, then taken on phonon. Of course, electron temperature always should be slightly different from phonon when you've got external heat. That's just a condition of your heat balance. But slightly different if you are close to linear regime, this difference could be infinitesimal. The point here is that this difference could become very strong. But that's okay, anyway, that's what happens in clean metal. Of course, as I told from the very beginning, we are dealing here with quite disordered metal, and one needs to take into account suppression of cooling by disorder. So dirty metal or low temperature limit happens when you've got this inequality, where QT is a typical thermal momentum of phonons. And this is actually, this factor is of order of 10 to the, it's roughly speaking between 10 to the minus 1 and 10 to the minus 2 in experiments I'm talking about. So these systems are quite dirty. And this is, sorry? No, I'm talking about high resistive state. Forget about gigaohms. Sorry, it's not gigaohms. I'm talking about a state before we go to over, before we jump to a huge resistance. I'm talking about low resistive states. And low resistive is where we are more or less in metal. Of course, it would be absolutely ridiculous to try to use this theory when we are in gigaohm regime. One thing, but I'll have something to say about this. But anyway, when they're just in dirty metal, where G is of order one, that's still, we've got this, which is absolutely well fulfilled. L, by the way, is of order of 80 or 100 angstrom over there, or 60, depends on material, but something of this order. So this is fulfilled, and then one needs to write kinetic equation for electron-photon interaction in the presence of disorder, taking into account that, this is just a note for connoisseurs, that when you got this interaction, your impurities are also driven by phonons. So in normal situation, impurities are not frozen. It's very hard to isolate them of phonons. They're also moving, and this is a term which takes into account this motion. It was, I think first was, sorry, didn't, yeah, Schmidt was the first to do it. He did it for dense metals, so he didn't have this P Fermi L cube factor. Then it was Reiser and Sergeyev who did it in 97, 98, sort of 15 years after Schmidt. Then many people also tried this approximation. Interesting is that sometimes you can get rid of this assumption where impurities are moving together with phonons. But it's very hard to arrange this experiment. Hard, but not impossible. But in normal situation, this should be taken into account. If people don't do this, they would find results which are very different, as some of our friends did. And if you take all this into account, H over tau if an electron phonon becomes proportional to t to the fourth instead of t cube, like in clean metal. Important also is that this additional factor as compared to clean metal t cube over tt squared, maybe about at 10 to the minus 4. So it's very small factor. So in dirty, low density semiconductors, electron phonon cooling becomes quite inefficient if you compare this to dense metal. So that's actually what I need to substitute into this heat balance equation. And I don't even need to use tau approximation. Actually, kinetic equation in this model can be solved exactly if I also go to Jelly approximation. And for very low temperatures, one might think that both Debye model and Jelly approximation is quite reasonable. They are only interested in long wave phonons anyway. And then I just rewrite this heat balance equation in dimensionless variables. And what happens here is that disorder disappears. For trivial reason, R here was containing the same power of mean free path as 1 over tau in the right-hand side. Therefore, equation for heat balance appears to be, well, in some weird way, rather universal. So that is why finishing model till then and calculating all coefficients, and you see even numerical coefficients conspired to give you just one, was rather reasonable. And you see there are very few things on which electric field inside of your material depends. It's only wavelengths, then this Arrhenius delta, which I have introduced from the very beginning, and just one material constant, which can be actually measured or extracted from literature independently of this particular experiment, because it includes only mass density of your material, transverse speed of light, transverse because it's always lower than longitudinal and therefore gives the major contribution, and that's it. So this material constant happened to be of order of few hundred Kelvin in materials I'm talking about. And then you just need to see what this equation leads to. So you see, it's, again, it's really school physics. It's not important. That's what we have used, that phonons came from 3D systems. But of course, if you change to 2D, all you do, you change shear power from. Yes. But remember, we are there. It's not a big assumption because we are at very low temperatures. Phonons don't exist. Phonons of course exist, but only with frequencies below temperature. So only long wave phonons. No, you can say that the phonon temperature would be this. There's T fridge. Yes. Yes. Sure. If we assume that phonons should only equilibrate within the sample, you would be right. But of course this is a big 3D sample where phonons have all the possibilities. No, it's not bad because why? Right. No. Sorry. Film electrons are living only in 2D film, which is here actually of order of 30 to 60 nanometers. 30 to 50 nanometers in thickness. All the arrangement, because this film is sitting on substrate, this substrate is sitting on some, so it's some mesa made for this film or whatever. When you take this all together, it's rather 3D from the viewpoint of phonons. It's of course more or less 2D from the viewpoint of where electrons interact with phonons. No, it's a film. It's a film, so there is of course a film boundary. But again, film boundary for phonons is much, especially for these long wave phonons, are much less important than for electrons or whatever. But no, it's not the other way around, because we are talking about very long wave. No. I'm not talking about resistance which is due to scattering by phonons. Oh no, of course, I don't know about, I don't know much about density of the material from which substrate is made, to be frank, have no idea. And in the last few papers which I looked at, they didn't even give the photos of experimental equipment, because I think that it's all pretty much standard. However, there is a very wild belief of experimentalists here that there is nothing very dramatic happening with phonons. Oh yes. But again, this many things are only now in making. So measuring phonon temperature or measuring, you see, Shakar is doing spectroscopy experiments for measuring overall temperature. It's much more harder here to distinguish electron temperature from phonon directly. But still, okay, I assume here, of course, that this phonon temperature is temperature of bath. Of overall phonons, it's 3D phonons in substrates, which also penetrate this. So I assume that there is overall oscillations between substrate and this film. Of course, it could be additional resistance on the boundary. Who would argue against this? But it doesn't matter when we are talking about such a rough things as overall equilibration. There is fridge temperature, it has something to do with temperature of phonons which are there, but it might have nothing to do with temperature of electrons. That's the only thing I want to stress here. Yes, I didn't check this. We can do it right on the spot, but let me postpone this till the end. But it's you know, we are talking about temperatures which are all below 1/10 of Kelvin, and goes as low as to 1/100th of Kelvin. So we are talking about rather long wave phonons, because otherwise it's sort of a normal material with density which is normal, speed of sound which is roughly speaking again normal, what you expect from this material. So everything here is standard. By the way, taking these figures from literature from somewhere, from the shelf, and substituting this to experimental data made full sense. We didn't have access to their data, and still these figures worked. So let me proceed a bit further. So all we need to do is actually to solve this equation. You see, now I have written an equation in terms of dimensionless temperature, dimensionless voltage, and all I need to find is at what voltage and at what critical temperature of the bath of phonons I may have unstable behavior in this equation. Of course, equation is trivial, so I don't need to tell you how do I do this, and just give the results. So you find that there is a critical phonon temperature, some critical temperature, below which instability occurs, and electron temperature can first follow very closely phonon temperature in high resistive states, but then becomes entirely independent on it, and becoming just some fraction of delta in low resistance state. So this is temperature of low resistance state, which is roughly speaking measures in this delta. Temperature of the cold high resistive state is very close to bus temperature. It's a bit different, of course, because you've got non-equilibrium. You've got some heat to disperse, but roughly speaking, here is linear, here is almost a constant, and this is some switching area. And this critical bus temperature depends only on delta. Nothing else is entering these results. And then you calculate threshold voltage. And for the cold high resistance state, is extremely strongly T-dependent. But of course, we are talking about instability. So you don't need to go to threshold. Your jump between two states can happen below threshold, but that's we are talking where it must happen. But it's very strongly T-dependent, while threshold for hot low resistance state is practically independent of bus temperature. It's a constant. And then we can see whether these features actually take place in experiments. Okay, what happens here? Electronic temperature will just go, it's probably better to see from this picture. Where is that? The very first one. You see, when you are here, electronic temperature will be practically equal to phonon temperature. When you are in this above, it will be totally independent of phonon temperature, but still it will be just one. Just one, which will be now defined by this Arrhenius delta. But important here that you've got this exclusion area where there is no temperature switch can occur, and that you've got very strong difference between T-dependence of voltages. Now you look at experiment, and here you look at threshold voltage for the hot low resistance state. That's when you go from here to there. And you see it's practically temperature independent. They're all very, very close to each other. I will show you other data when they really have no temperature dependence whatsoever. All will be the same vertical line. But when you go to the threshold voltage for cold state, high resistance, when you go from high resistance to low resistance, so you change voltage, you always change voltage in this direction. But of course, only modulus of voltage matters. So here you go from low resistive state to high resistive state, you jump down, and here you jump up. And all these jumps now becomes strongly temperature dependent. So there is already a qualitative evidence that hysteresis actually works as it should for this bistable temperature. And also quite interesting to see that this is in the latest experiment by Shahar group, that they are able to measure behavior in high resistive state before it goes to this noisy area. So it's not just that. There is some dependence which is practically linear on log scale. So some interesting dependence could be measured there as well. I'll talk about this in a moment. And of course, we've got nonlinear IV characteristics. That's what we've got from our equation, from this trivial equation which I have written. You've got high resistive state here, low resistive state here, and IV characteristics go like that, S shape. Of course, this is unstable. There are experimental ways to go into this instability and to see whether it may occur, but it hasn't been done yet. But what might happen experimentally, you just jump. And when you go from low resistance, you jump here. And always jumps are hysteretic. Here they occur at different voltages, here all the same. And these jumps, as you can see from this picture, predict correctly a few orders of magnitude, 4, 5, 6, whatever you need, using the data which I'll show you in a moment. So it looks very similar to experiment. But what is really a smoking gun evidence is this picture, which is extracted in the last paper by Shahar group. They just look at temperature exclusion zone, and they experimentally extract this pattern, which you see is practically the same as this. So it's very hard to believe that any other mechanism would do precisely the same feature. But of course, we also can go to some quantitative comparison. We've got very few data to match. As I told you, this delta naught is material constant, which we can take from literature. You don't need to bother Shahar or Baturina asking them what are their values. And all we need to know is their Fermi wavelength. There is density, it's known quite well. And their delta. This is the only fitting parameter, but it's not fit by us. It's a parameter which was used by experimentalists to fit their data. And then we've got this expression for the voltage threshold. And we calculated, so a theoretical estimate, we've got voltage threshold at 0.8 millivolt and critical temperature at 190 millik. And this is experimental data, 1 millivolt and 120 millik. It's actually too good to be true. And probably it's not entirely true. I'll tell about it in a moment, why it's not always that good. But here, of course, the fact that we didn't use any fitting and whatever and got this very good coincidence, this experiment, is quite telling. There is a reasonable agreement in a wider range delta for also Baturina experiment. We have extracted data from her experiment and see that the agreement is not that brilliant, but still always discrepancy by factor less than 2. So we are sitting quite well within expected errors. However, of course, the point is that the law there is not entirely Arrhenius. Actually, Arrhenius' law is very good for describing experimental data at zero magnetic field. But at finite field, it's definitely a good deviation from Arrhenius. So gamma in Arrhenius' law is already not 1, but something like not 9, not 85, and probably it's not really that good description. But here, just to illustrate, if I take gamma 1/2, F. Rashkolovsky, I would have critical temperature, which is 4 to the times 10 to the minus 3 of delta. So it's already well below experimental value. If I take gamma equal 1/4, like Mohr's law, I would have critical temperature 10 to the minus 6 of delta. Of course, this is just for illustration, because if I've got variable range hopping, all these considerations where there is different electron and photon temperature will not go. But it means that gamma should be rather close to 1, it is, but it's not ideally Arrhenius' law. What experimentalists did, Avadia, Sasepa, and Shahar in their last paper, they just took their experimental value for equilibrium R of T, substituted into our balance equation, and got from their predictions for non-equilibrium behavior. And this was absolutely spot on. So if you don't use a single parameter for a fitting, but just take the whole curve as measured in linear regime before all these jumps occur, in ohmic regime, and substitute, then coincidence again is excellent. There is also a nice scaling law which tells you what is this power beta. This has been checked by experimentalists, and beta equals 6, which corresponds to this model of electron phonon cooling in dirty environment, seems to fit experiments absolutely fantastically. So it looks that this is really a mechanism. But what we can't explain, even not talking about materials with high magnetic fields. So I again show this current voltage characteristic which he has got, and we can measure in high resistance state how strongly this current changes. Qualitatively, it by the way shows precisely behavior which they expect. It looks almost linear in semi-logarithmical coordinates, but it's not. It's not exponential law, it's more complicated, but it looks like exponential. So from this viewpoint, it's qualitatively in agreement with experiment. However, experimentally, this ratio from here to here could be 10 or 20. In our case, is unfortunately smaller than E. E is not electron charges, 2.71. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You asking? Sorry, what? Yes. Oh, it's not. It's not, of course. It's there is no. That's what I told you. There is no this linearity, but this is a numerical solution. And so this because you can't solve this exactly. It's trivial, but still transcendental equation. So when you write numerical solution, it looks as if it's almost log linear. Because experimenters, when they first got these results before our work, they thought that they see this exponential behavior because it was very easy to fit their data by this exponent. But when they saw our equations, they fit their experimental data no worse, with one exception. Here, we've got change of current, which is really limited, no more than 3, roughly speaking, and they see much bigger change of current. Absolutely, and this limitation doesn't depend on beta or gamma, which means that if we change Arrhenius law, or if we change electron-phonon cooling mechanism, we still be more or less within the same limitation. How can we live this limitation? The only way which we came about was to introduce a second length scale, a part of electron phonon scattering. If we've got a two scale scattering, then it's very easy to fit everything. But you know, having a fitting parameter, one can fit practically everything. But I mind you, here is fitting 3. So when I say about two-scale scattering, I introduce just one fitting parameter, ratio of this scale. If I introduce this, I can get whatever I want. But then, of course, it implies that some microscopic understanding is necessary. And of course, you can't get to this just on a purely phenomenological basis, as we did here. Yes, of course. I can show you again this. It's raw data, unfortunately, but you can see it's here. Ratio, it's, what is the ratio? You can't take ratio from here to here. You can take from maximum value to the level of noise, because any statement below noise are irrelevant, right? And then it's temperature dependent, but you see it's temperature dependent because of actually methodological limitations. They just cannot measure it more exactly. So what going on in reality, we just don't know. But of course, when you go to higher temperature, it eventually goes to this behavior, which doesn't show any bistability, and still got this sort of quasi-log linear behavior. Okay, so. There is no evidence. There is no direct. Sure. In theory, definitely it is. Of course, in experiments, they try to see whether they can see any local overheating due to strong inhomogeneity. They can't notice it, but it doesn't matter because you don't need much to have this in locality. It's not clear how to measure it experimentally. It's very clear how to take it into account theoretically. If you want to describe dynamics of this bistability, this inhomogeneity would be the main contributor to such a dynamics. And it's relatively easy to write, I'm not sure on this here, but it's relatively easy to write equation how the domain wall you'll be propagating in the system, which will be making them the system from low to high resistive state or whatever, due to inhomogeneity. Okay, anyway, but experimentally it's not yet possible to estimate. Roughly speaking, with the level of their accuracy, temperature is the same along the entire sample. But you understand that a very low difference in temperature is already enough to introduce inhomogeneous correction. So I can't tell anything more about this. So just returning to whatever is left to say is very little, because what I told you is very simple. So again, to beat this feature, we need to have a second scale. And of course, you might have a second scale if you think about some non-trivial thing which might or might not happen there. But this will go beyond this phenomenological picture, which I only wanted to show you. So overheating, that's the reason in our understanding. That goes quite well with latest experimental data. Special measurements made to measure this bistability temperature, whatever, showed fantastic qualitative agreement. And in most cases, there is also very good quantitative agreement. Is this too mundane? Again, as I told, it's not was not readily expected on the insulating side. But we clearly see here that this difference in temperatures take place. It was not really seriously looked after, because everybody had in mind the variable Lange Hopping mechanism for the insulators. Therefore, you don't expect any overheating. And it was checked for and vigorously denied by the French group, which I have shown, Ladier and collaborators. They thought about possibility in this white silicon samples that it might be due to overheating. And they checked this using textbook values for electron phonon cooling rate. And this is a difference about four orders of magnitude, because they just used clean metal values. And with this, electron phonon cooling was efficient enough not to lead to any overheating. We can see actually here that values are very important. You shift these coefficients, beta, whatever, you change things quite strongly. You change the value of overheating, and you will lose this bistability region at all. So they just missed it because they used wrong values for their results. Well, anyway, it definitely requires a new approach to electron hopping at low T, at least in these systems. The experimental paper, which is published back-to-back with ours, has a title, The Non-Phonon Hopping Mechanism at Low Temperature Conductivity. So that's, I think, is now quite clearly evidenced. There is no phonon hopping, and therefore something else should be there. Could be this something else due to, for example, many-body electron localization. I imply for those who knows work by Basco, Alshuler, Alenier. That's two of our collaborators are very keen on this idea. Two other collaborators, me including, are a bit more in a sort of cool state. So somebody in hot state, somebody in cool state. There is a certain bistability, but the reason for this is that the second scale, of course, could be given by electron localization in many-body space. Unfortunately, it gives it in the opposite direction. If you just directly lift data from their results, it will not work. So something going on there, but we don't know yet what. And I remind you that we don't know yet the most trivial question: why in this sort of materials linear resistance without any voltage or whatever behaves in quasi-Arrhenius way. There are, of course, some ideas on this sort, but all which we checked, it did not survive comparison with experimental data. So all straightforward ideas didn't work. So this remains an open question, and to my taste, quite interesting. So to summarize, we claim that electron overheating due to inefficient cooling is actually the reason for these giant jumps. There is good agreement with experiment without fitting parameters. We don't have microscopic description. And direct measurements of the electron temperature in the Hopper regime is, of course, a very interesting challenge. Now, some experimentalists think how to do it along this line. And finally, although I have not written here, not every time when you see experimental data which are not immediately understood, you need to proclaim the existence of a new state of matter. Thank you.